Hi, and welcome to another edition of Visions with me, Yudeli Wickham Ashby. And today I'm deeply honored and very, very pleased to have back in the studio with me Erin Brown from the Bahamas. Hi, Erin.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
Right. So last time we talked a bit about how you lost your leg as a result of having cancer and then getting very active after you returned to the Bahamas, you know, getting into cycling, getting into advocacy and being a consultant around disability matters. So we had a very exciting conversation the last time, and I want us to continue because you did mention that you have children. And I think that it's important because sometimes the public view on us as parents can be a bit negative. And I want you to really speak about your role as a parent and how your children have responded to you.
Yes. Oh, thank you. That is a timely question. And I say that because I just had a conversation with a group of parents, and we were talking about being a non-disabled parent of disabled children or being a disabled parent with non-disabled or disabled children. And so for me, when I was diagnosed, my son was literally 4 months old. And I really didn't think nothing of it. When I was diagnosed, I had to go straight into chemotherapy. I had to leave him thinking that I was going to come back over the weekend, but it was basically about a year or so later that I was able to see him in person again. And I recall coming home with my amputation. And it's amazing how kids embrace different experiences. He got so used to me. When it was time to go, I would put on my 1 foot of shoe and grab my pair of crutches in order to go. So anytime he saw me pick up a shoe, like one shoe, he putting on his two. Because his mind, he was like, mommy going out and I'm about to go out with her. I think for me, though, my experience with parenthood is a very unique one. When I was about 12, my mom was diagnosed with lupus. And so most of my adolescence was being with her, being her caretaker, because, you know, even our minor kids, when we are ill or we are living with a disability, become our caretakers. Mm-hmm. And I, up until I was 17 in grade 12 when she passed, a lot of those experiences, I reflected on those as a parent now during my cancer journey and after my amputation when I was engaging with my son, because I started to think to myself, well, how is my son really going to feel? He seemed to be having an okay time with it because he's going wherever I'm going. He's actually seeing more persons with disabilities because he's with me, being so active. But then when he was now 6 and 7 and 9 years old, and I'm now like volunteering in his class, I'm not just dropping him off to school, I'm coming out of the car. And so all of the kids are like, whoa, she has one leg. Or, oh man, how did that happen? And they're talking to him, you know. Mm-hmm. I started to think about it. I was like, oh boy, was this a good idea? Mm-hmm. I don't know. This might be a lot of pressure for a young child to explain or to comprehend or to process. But I was glad that I did that because it allowed him to ask questions. It allowed his friends to ask questions and ask me questions. They saw in real time a disabled parent like myself who was limb difference, being an above-the-knee amputee, participating in the field trips, participating in all of their activities, you know, going on places with them. And it was not that I couldn't do it. It was, I enjoyed doing it as well. So that kind of helped me quenched a lot of the, am I really a good mom? Is this something that is going to negatively impact my child? How did I feel about it? I was relatively okay with it because I was able to interact with my child. I could not gain employment, so I was all his and he was all mine in his activities. So whether it was sports or in person, we did things together. But when he became an adolescent, that's when I really started to have those self-doubt talks to myself. Because now, they need more. He's now playing basketball and softball. We don't have transportation. So how do I get him to these things? We're catching public bus. It was just so much. And I worried that I was not enough as a mom.
And I think that's, and I think, yeah, and I think that's one of the big questions that most parents have, those self-doubts really creep in, even as early as the child is, primary school age. So I think that's those are questions that we have to really answer honestly and work on so that we do build that bond with our child or children and allow them to feel comfortable and, free to really discuss it with us.
That part. Because even when it was awkward, when he asked me a question, I found a common ground because I was understanding and I was acknowledging that he was getting to know me. He was getting to figure out some things because him and the kids are having conversations. He's hearing other parents having talks or even family members saying certain things. So he's trying to figure it out. But for me, I found that when he got older, and I couldn't really keep up with a lot of stuff when it comes to like finance and stuff. I started to really sit there and say, maybe I should allow another person to look after him, or maybe I should decide to step back and I don't know. I struggled with a lot of self-conversation. And guess what? I was competing, I was traveling and speaking. But I still had those moments where I didn't feel like I was possibly not the best mom for him. And it was because I was thinking and listening to society telling me that, they're always telling us in our community what we should do, what we shouldn't do, who should have kids, who shouldn't have kids. And so now it became, now you messing with me now. And I need to figure this out because I need to be able to answer not only my child, but I need to be able to answer for myself how I feel about this. So I was fortunate. I was fortunate that I was able to not only lead conversations, but I was able to defend. They tell me I have the gift for talk. So I was able to defend how I felt about things, whether you agreed with it or not. And that built my confidence to say I'm the right mom for my son.
Right. And I think your point is extremely valid because we internalize a lot of what society projects onto us, and that then raises our self-doubts and lead to low self-confidence and sometimes us making some very poor choices and decisions on very important matters in terms of really parenting and doing the best for our children. And
Absolutely.
then you had a second child.
Yes. Oh my gosh. So during my cancer journey, you go to your yearly checkups, then your monthly checkups, and all of a sudden, when I went for my checkups, they then say to me, "Congratulations." And I went, "I'm sorry, what test do you take? You have congratulations for." And they were like, "Oh, you're 5 months pregnant." What? I was told I couldn't have any more kids. So I had already made up my mind, and in my mind, it was like, okay, so I have one and done. But I then had a wonderful daughter who came and who stayed on this earth for 18 months. She unfortunately passed away, but she was my motivator because at 18 months, she was fully potty trained. She was talking in sentences. She was the queen of the house. I had relieved my duties because she knew it all and she could say it all and she could demand what she wanted. And so when she passed, what that did for me was that jumpstart me. That's really when I started to say, okay, enough is enough, Erin. She had a purpose. She came here and we not only did things together, we went to my son's baseball game. She would be there with me. And so imagine this. I am a mother with a pair of crutches on. I do not have my prosthetic leg at this time. And strapped in front of me is this 10, 11-pound-year-old child. Because if I put her on the ground, she gone. And
Correct.
I can't run after her. So strapped onto me is her and my son is next to me with all of his baseball stuff. And persons just used to be looking like, well, where is this woman going? What is she out here doing? And I was the team's like manager. I did all the scoring. I was also the loudest cheerleader, which to the chagrin of my son. He was like, Mommy, you're a little bit too loud. But I was very present. And so when she passed is what caused me to really reflect on our time here is fleeting. It is short.
It
And we
is.
have to decide how we're going to show up. And so even though it was unexpected, she was the driving force that when I met that prosthetist in the airport, I said exactly how I felt. I was clear on what I had in my goals. And therefore, that following year, I was doing the marathon. And it was all because of her passing.
Right. And how did your son deal with her passing?
He's still dealing. And that's actually a question that I've always wanted to like sit down and like pick his brain. Two questions. How do you feel with me being a mom? Because he's a 21-year-old adult now. So he's processed some things. And I would love to like have that like one-on-one with him. But also, we have been very, very open with the loss of his sister, as well as my first daughter, and how we feel about it. So some moments were really good, some moments were not. I never ever asked him to push down his feelings. He was always very vocal. I remained very present for him, and that helped both of us in the grieving process, but also to continue on because eventually, I got married and I had another daughter. And she's 9 now. And no one was happier than him. It was unexpected to me because I really was like, listen, no more kids. I had already decided that because my mom passed from lupus and I still have that trait. So I didn't want to trigger it by having more kids. And then I'm a cancer survivor. And so I made up my mind that okay, my two was my contribution to the population.
And I
But
think one of the other difficult conversations is genetic counseling, which we don't really do a lot, so that persons can get a clearer understanding of how their particular condition may impact a pregnancy or a newborn.
absolutely. Because of my mom, when she was diagnosed with lupus, I had his like family data that not only did she had lupus, her brother had lupus, her niece had lupus. And so it's obviously within our genetics. And after inquiring about it, they said it may skip me, but my children may have precedent to experience that type of diagnosis or their children. And so I was very aware of that. There was also a fact that after the age of 35, persons living with lupus or persons who have that genetic trait, having more children in childbearing ages will flare it, will cause it to present. And so I made up my mind that, okay, at 35, if I don't have any more kids, I'm not going to have any more. I was very intentional about that. And what's the saying? When God hears your plans, he laughs. Because I got married at 34. And I had her September, sorry, I had her in July of before I turned 35. And so I got tied off. I decided having her in our hospitals, they were very, very concerned that their patients did not include a cancer survivor who was also an amputee, who also had births not through C-section, and also was carrying a 10-pound baby.
Yes.
It just said, I was a soldier.
And still is. But what did your husband think about all of what you've experienced and having a baby?
I think at first, because I had already stated to them, I'm not going to have any more kids. Mm-hmm. And so when I went into the doctor for the scheduled tubal ligation, and they said, we're going to have to wait because you're pregnant. Mm-hmm. He was more surprised. I just was shocked. I was absolutely shocked because I was preparing to go and leave the Bahamas to do some intense training for Paralympics. And so we had to push that on the side. So I was dealing with that feeling. But he was just very shocked. He was like, I had already made up my mind we weren't going to have any kids. And now you're talking about being pregnant. And 5 months at that? Like, hold on now. Like, this is a lot. But I think for my husband at the time, because we're currently divorced. Right. I think my husband at the time, it was a lot. It was a lot for him. Mm-hmm. And you know, for some people, you can work through that. And for some people, it just is, I really have to be honest, this is not the plan. And so I think it was okay. But by the time it was time to have the baby, you kind of saw that, okay, maybe this wasn't okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think that some men find it extremely difficult because after you've made up your mind and have come, you know, you've reconciled that this is not going to happen, and then for it to happen puts you in a tailspin. So it means now that your many emotions are awakened and you have to deal with that, deal with the reality of having a newborn and a wife with a disability and the societal pressure.
Yes, 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 absolutely. And so for some people, you can push through. For others, you just may have to decide that, okay, it's you and we're going to do the best that we can. For me personally, I think I was more not disappointed, but more hurt because when you feel like you can do anything with a partner. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And you were so used to doing things on your own and you now had a partner and then you're back to you're on your own. And so for me, dealing with that emotion took a while for me to really process because it wasn't that I wasn't used to doing things by myself. I had already gotten to the mindset of I don't have to do it by myself anymore.
Right. Yes. And it's a wonderful feeling to have that companionship and that support from your partner.
Yeah. So, but I've come to a place in life where I realize that a lot of things that at first glance we see as tragedies and, oh, why me? Why this happened to me? But they have been my stepping stone in my growth, in my purpose. And also in teaching me that you are valuable just the way you are. You have what you need, Erin. You have what you need. Just let's keep working, keep moving forward, and you will see that everything will be provided.
Nice, wonderful. And I think many times we need to do that positive self-talk to ourselves so that we're able to deal with whatever calamity, whatever obstacles present themselves to us, you know? So that's wonderful, Erin. Now, so you have your two children, you would have experienced two losses and a divorce, and you are still striving. So tell us a bit now about your work at the University of the Bahamas.
Sure. So at the University of the Bahamas, I lead the Office of Disabilities and Compliance. And as a disabled professional and a disability inclusion consultant by profession, it has been such a powerful and impactful journey. The saying that, you know, reaching one person at a time is a very, very realistic one. A lot of times we think about large numbers and we say we want everybody, but understand that starting with one becomes two, becomes three, will eventually be everybody. And so when I first came into the office, we had about four registered students. We're currently rounding about 40 to 50 students.
Wonderful.
And that has been a very humbling experience to get there, because one of the things that we know in our community that happens is the stigma. And what the University of the Bahamas has effectively done for our national dialogue in education is the integration of inclusive education, honoring our special education spaces and the support and the growth and development that they provide those students, with the intent of now integrating them into mainstream, into inclusive spaces, into a space that provides access for all learners, has been a powerful one in higher education. Mm-hmm. And not just for the students, but for faculty, staff, and administration. I found more professionals who are disabled teachers, who are disabled administrators. They're now applying for jobs within higher education.
Wonderful. After
recognizing that we do exist in these spaces and there is more room for us.
So share with us then, how did you adjust? Because I know sometimes being the first or maybe being the only person in that industry can be a bit of a challenge, and in terms of how your colleagues may respond to you and how easy or difficult the path may be for you to achieve your goals.
Yes, I'm still adjusting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm absolutely still adjusting. And I have recognized that I'm okay being the first or the only. What I'm not okay with is if you're going to intentionally keep it that way. So what that means, I am the first because we have to start.
Right.
So my intention and my goal is to create and foster a space that attracts, that retains, and that advances persons just like me. Professionals in my community, those who are looking for more leadership opportunities and development in our community, we need to ensure that we are doing what is necessary, not only by law and by policy, but by the sole purpose of human rights-based approach.
Yes.
Ensuring that access, inclusion, and opportunities are for all human beings across the industries, the basic needs, the advancements. We must foster those spaces. So for me, I am prepared to be on my own, yet I intend to build and strengthen and develop others to join me or to take it over. Because our purpose is not to remain in one space. That's not growth. Our
Correct.
purpose is to come in and impact change in a very unique and purposeful way, so that when you leave that space, persons are empowered, have the tools or the passion to move forward and develop even more. So it's still a work in progress, but I'm absolutely grateful, because despite me not seeing tangible things that I could put my finger on, you can feel the difference in conversations. A lot of unconscious biases are now being acknowledged, and therefore it's not being used or weaponized. It's more of, okay, you're right. I felt this way because of that. And therefore I now have more knowledge and I can action differently. I can be an ally. And so that's what I'm experiencing more, not only within the university, but with throughout the Bahamas, in our spaces. We have more allyship happening now. So it's been well worth it.
And I think that's the approach that we need to see happening more often. And I would want to say that generally in the Caribbean, there isn't that push for a human rights approach to disability matters, to any matter really. And if we take that human rights approach in the educational sector, in the healthcare sector, wherever, it does impact and make a significant difference in how persons are respected and treated, you know, how they're provided with the necessary services. So I think that is extremely valuable. And the other point that you made, which we need to see happening more often, is the true discussion, the honest discussion around our prejudices and biases towards persons who we consider different, whether they're people with disabilities, whether they're the elderly people, whether they're the albinos, whoever we view as being different. I think we need sometimes to have the individual as well as the group discussion around our prejudices, so that we can start to strip them and we can acknowledge, yes, I did have this bias towards persons who are blind or persons who have other types of disabilities or the elderly or, you know, short people or tall people. So we do need to have these type of honest conversations on a more regular basis, so that it then frees up our communities to be at peace, to be comfortable with persons with disabilities in the same communities.
Yes, and it empowers us to honor our true and authentic selves. We're empowering ourselves as well to be that change, and to acknowledge and to ask for help and support. Yes. It's difficult to ask for things, whether you have a disability or not. It's the human experience. When you've recognized that you have an entire community, whether in your region or outside of your region, that is advocating, amplifying, and living in success with a disability, you know that you can do it. And therefore, you have more of that confidence that, yes, I need to say more. I need to do more.
Definitely, Erin, because the power is there behind us. And I really want to say, Erin, it has been an absolute pleasure chatting with you today and allowing us to have a greater insight into your world of being a mother, being a para athlete, and of course, being an advisor in the area of education. I must say, Erin, it has been wonderful meeting you over again and just learning more about you. And thank you very much for allowing us to really share with you as well.
It has been an absolute pleasure. It is always an amazing time when we're together.
Yes.
So thank you for giving me the opportunity once again.
Thank you, my pleasure. And the synergies are good. Well, you have been listening to Visions with me, Yodelee Wickham Ashby, and my very special guest today, Erin Brown from the Bahamas. So you can reach me on 1-246-269-9660 or 1-246-430-7300. You can email me at visionsbarbados@gmail.com, and you can check this and past episodes by going to the VOB929.com website. So until next week, I want to say thank you for listening to us and spread the word. So remember, love yourself and love your neighbor as you love yourself. Until then, ciao.